It's time for The Citizen Lobbyist, a discussion of local, borough, and state politics featuring Terry Snyder and Mike Malefsky.
Hello, Citizen Lobbyist.
Morning, Mike.
How are you today? Have you survived another day of heat here in September?
Boy, there just isn't a prettier time of year, I think. The sunshine has been great, but the leaves turning and the look of those mountains as you're driving in to Palmer, no matter what direction you're coming, are pretty amazing.
It is that. It is that. No doubt. Well, let's look at the meetings we covered. There were a number of them that happened this week. There was this joint meeting in particular that had the assembly and the school board meeting together. And I have some reports from the members who participated that they suggested that it was one of the better joint meetings they've had. Do you want to start with that one?
Sure. Yeah, in that they had a pretty substantial agenda, that's for sure. All members of the school board were there. The only member of the assembly that was missing was Mr. Kawaki. But they did take up a substantial amount of things. Their first joint business items of business had to do with building construction progress and the review of their construction plans, or their CIP list, as people like to refer it. That was given by Mike Brown from the school district. He used to work at the borough, now has worked at the school district for several years. He gave a couple of really good handouts. We should be reminded that the borough is still having problems with all their technology from their cyber attack, so they didn't have it up, but they did have plenty of handouts at the back of the room having to do with public facilities, and he put together a couple of nice presentations. He went over, which I think is always a good place to start, Mike, of what the borough and the district, or what the state requires the boroughs and the district to do as far as it comes to school, and a lot of people sometimes get confused because they're not aware of what the state requires the facilities to either in size to be like, or the maintenance that's required, reporting, that sort of thing. He also talked about the fact that the borough builds the buildings and owns all the buildings, and the district takes care of them out of their budget with custodial and O&M operations part of their budget, which not very much these days. He also talked about the current bond debt and where the retirement of that bond debt will be. Of course, listeners may remember that in years past, when we built the last five schools, the state had a generous offer where they picked up 70% of that funding, and the taxpayers were only required to have 30%. But it's been suspended. They're saying that it'll come back in 2020, but what they're planning on bringing it back is a 50-50 split when that happens. So the school district is already planning for that, what they can do within those to improve their facilities and work on their capital budget plan without adding any more to taxpayer burden. So taxpayers' amount would remain flat, and it would just depend on what amount is retired from the debt then. So lots of really good information. I always encourage people to listen to that. There were some questions from the assembly that I think Mr. Brown addressed pretty well. And that was a good way to start it off. Then there was a report from on safe routes to school. This is something that the school board wanted the assembly members to know, all the safety measures that they've taken. Of course, nobody should not know about some of the incidents in the lower 48. And years ago, they recall, we even had one in Bethel, Alaska here with guns in schools. And they talked about all the different operations that they have been doing and training programs to make kids safe in school. And what I liked about Monica's Superintendent Scoia's presentation is that she talked about the importance of trying to get to the problem before it happens, in that almost all of these incidences in the school are done by disgruntled former students or present students. And she talked about all the measures that they're trying to do to track students, get other students comfortable with reporting things that may the school district may need to know about kiddos that are having problems, and also just, you know, working with kids before they get to high school, because most all of the incidences have been, other than Sandy Hook, a lot of them have been at the, you know, the high school era. And so she made a really good case for that, I think.
Well, before we move on, I just wanted to lean back toward the bond question mm-hmm. and issue. Because mm-hmm. what I thought happened from the assembly standpoint, at least a member or two, raising questions about the bond repayment schedule, and later on to the idea that you're really going to be continuing to have a repayment schedule continuing on because you needed to continue bonding in order to make sure that the facilities would be maintained, et cetera. And I think there may be two approaches people have. One is kind of episodic, where you think, okay, I'll pay money, I'll do this, and I don't have to do anything for a long time, and then I'll do it again, rather than having a schedule of maintenance that means that you're going to be paying all the time for maintenance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it was there was a question by an assembly member talking about getting money from the state about maintenance, and that just doesn't happen. They do pay for, when we've had catastrophes like the Sioux Valley fire, when that school burnt down, the state stepped in, but then we went to our insurance company too. So the everyday maintenance of buildings, we should point out, we've gotten 5 new schools and they haven't added any real staff to operations and maintenance for those 5 new schools. That all falls under the general budget of the school district. And I think what they're looking at, according to their, you know, sort of their facility blueprint, is they do acknowledge, Mr. Brown does, that they do have when you have that many buildings, 47 schools, they have $145 million in deferred maintenance that needs to be taken care of. And they aren't unlike the city of Palmer and, you know, city of Wasilla. Everybody across the country has deferred maintenance right now. But they're trying to make a measured approach to those things while keeping the cost of the taxpayers flat with some future planning and addressing it that way. So I think what people are sensitive about is increases in their tax amount. What the approach the school district is taking is we'll be able to retire some debt, but we're not saying we're not going to take on new debt, but we're going to do it at the level it's being retired. That was my understanding.
Right, right. It's just a realization that really, over a period of time, you're going to come out ahead if you do regular maintenance rather than let things deteriorate and then have to do this major thing and then back and forth this way.
Well, and you know, a lot of these schools, all schools are built differently depending on the era they were built. Some are more sustainable than others.
Right.
A lot of the schools are on septic and well water, a lot of hard water in the schools. And that includes, you know, the HVAC systems and the boiler systems and all of those things that need water. There's a lot of wear and tear, but the school district did point out that the average lifespan that schools get, the state, you know, the level that they ask for, they exceed that by about 6 years on their facilities. So they're pretty proud of the way they take care of their schools. And, you know, they're not shy about the fact that they're using students to help that cause, you know, trying to keep the schools cleaner and that sort of thing. Because we should not forget, too, that they're used for public use a lot.
Right.
So it's not just during the school day. There's a lot of people that use those on the weekend. And in fact, I think there's still some churches that hold their services in schools for a very minimal amount. So those are really, they're borough, they belong to the building, the boroughs, the building maintenance of it, the everyday maintenance, and even things like water heaters and roofs and those sort of things. The borough doesn't pay for, the school district pays for. And those leasehold improvements and that sort of thing. So that's kind of what they covered. And then they had an enrollment update, Mike.
Right.
And, yeah, enrollment's up as they thought it would be. They're about 130 students under enrollment, not unusual this time of year. A lot of kids haven't started up. People fish hunt. Homeschoolers are typically the ones that sign on later. But they think they're going to come right on target. So the next 20 days traditionally is when a lot of the homeschoolers sign in, and Metsu Central is one of the schools that is under enrollment. Some of them are significantly over enrollment. I was surprised to see the Big Lake numbers. And so they think the other point that the superintendent wanted to make, which is just stunning to me, that 44% of our kids are living in poverty. So every other student is hitting that federal bar of poverty, which is just kind of a stunning statistic to me. I think all but two of our schools are federally recognized as being Title I schools. That's a pretty stunning figure, I think.
And it
means
a lot
of work on the part of the school district. So, yeah, that was kind of it. They had a really good presentation from the Matsu Health Foundation, having to do with their Rock Matsu program, Raising Our Children with Kindness, just a really excellent program of how that started out and how much they're really trying to work with making schools what they call trauma-informed and asking kids not what's wrong with you, but just what's happening to you, and teaching teachers how to teach kids de-escalation techniques and techniques to self-regulate, so we don't have that in schools as much. So a lot of work going on with there, and they've partnered a lot of organizations they're partnering with. They've trained some 2,000 people on the ACEs study, you know, adverse childhood effects study now. They have 30 community partners. They're really working hard with the school district to work with those kiddos that just don't have great life experiences at home. That was a really good, and if you haven't interviewed Desiree Scheffler from Rock Matsu, who we should put her on the list, Mike. She gives a really nice.
We actually did.
Okay.
Interview her. She was in with Jillian Morrissey, and we had a great interview. That, by the way, is up on our website. So we put up all of the inside the schools and that kind of connection up there, so you can catch that. Yes, that program's
great. Last little bit, Mike, was having to do with the test scores. This is a frequent discussion that they have about testing. You probably know more about testing than anybody, Mike, because you used to be on the school board and was a teacher, and how testing is not the only story of what's going on in kids' lives.
Right.
Part of it has to do with the fact that the national testing that often shows up. There was an article in ADN not long ago about it. Part of it is that they changed the whole national testing program some years ago and made it more robust and rigorous, as they like to say. And that made everybody's test scores go down as they changed those standards. We've changed our own standards, but they really had a great flyer titled Measures of Student Success that they plan to have on the website along with some frequently asked questions so that people can understand that. The good news is in both in English and math, even though, you know, we're still working on getting those scores better, they're the highest now of the five big five schools in testing. So doing better than Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, they're doing really, really well with those. So they're really proud of the fact that at least, you know, they're leading their pack, but not to say they're, you know, they need to work. Everybody needs to work harder on it.
So
testing was a big process.
The interesting thing about what you've just described is that the meeting was described as a joint borough assembly school board meeting. It would seem so far, was happening was a discussion of the school district itself. Were there any other elements, because I missed part of the meeting, that were addressing borough issues?
No. No, I mean, this is typically what a joint school board assembly meeting is. I mean, it's them talking about not legislation that has to do with what the borough is talking about. This is talking about bringing the assembly up to date on what's going on and addressing their concerns. So for instance, the school security update, I kind of gleaned over that, but we could talk about that more, was something Assemblyman Leonard wanted to talk about.
Right.
Member Doty wanted to talk about raising our kids with kindness or the ROC program.
Right.
And Mr. Sykes wanted to talk about the test scores. So they are agenda items that are brought by the assembly that they want to know a little bit more, something they've been hearing from their constituents and are questioning.
So it's interesting that the school board, in this case, does not have questions for the assembly.
I guess you could say it that way. It's more of a defense thing. Although I will say that Superintendent Goya comes to a lot of assembly meetings,
right,
and she asks questions.
Right.
So as the board, maybe not so much. Now, they oftentimes do have things on their agenda asking the school board or the assembly for support on. Or, you know, I think the last meeting was when they were talking about end-of-year funds. And they were asking for the assembly to support the transfer of their end-of-year funds. I think every particular agenda is different. And this one was really a lot of things requested of
from the school board.
From the school board of the of information. So
yeah. Okay.
Everybody has an interest in the enrollment rate. It was really a good meeting.
Well,
we're over about 8 o'clock. Just a little before eight, Mike. I think they were gone. I will note that not only Assemblyman George McKee was in a tie. I don't think I've seen that before. He made a comment that he thought that Superintendent Goya was a great superintendent.
Well, there we go.
That was good. That was the capper. So
at the same time that that was going on, actually, that meeting began at 6, starting at 7 over across town. Palmer City Council was having a meeting, and it was a relatively short meeting as well. I just wanted to touch upon one thing that I think, in part we can address maybe during Valley Edition. There's a whole bunch of topics for Valley Edition. And one of those topics has been on the front page of the Anchorage Daily News, top right across the top, and has to do with the settlement of a suit brought by an individual in ACLU against the City of Palmer and the Palmer Police Department. And I think we'll save the discussion for that for Valley Edition, because. Really, this meeting Tuesday did not discuss that in any way. And there was a second thing that was not discussed, but I think bears pointing out that what was introduced was a total revision, replacing of the present legislation that exists concerning bed and breakfasts in the city of Palmer. And I would suggest that if listeners are interested in that, they go to the City of Palmer website, and you can get the agenda, and you can get all the materials supporting it, and read what that introduction is about, because it will be discussed in 2 weeks at the next Palmer City Council meeting, and there will be a chance for a public hearing, et cetera. And this is a pretty significant change. And it's worth thinking about, particularly since bed and breakfasts have become very popular in many other places. And this changes the rules of the game. And if you were considering doing something like that, you may want to look at it and decide whether you want to support or raise questions about one or another aspect of it. So that was another thing that wasn't discussed, but is pretty significant.
I saw the tape is up on the website, Mike. I listened to the testimony, your testimony actually on that, and also have just glimpsed at the substantial change that they're asking for. And I noted last night that Councilman Pete LaFrance was asking for some input, and the input was really interesting, varied all over the map, whether people supported it or not. But I really encourage people to read it, because I think there'll be changes to what I've seen so far, and I need to look at it again, too. But it is a question. There are pros and cons to it, and there are effects, both good and bad, if you look at other places. I didn't see any numbers on one of the big concerns I saw on Facebook was in some areas where housing is already a problem, that it depletes inventory of rentals. I don't know what our rent occupancy rate is. From what I looked at, it looks like it was about 22%. So there seems to be plenty of occupancy, but hard to say. And then I'm not quite sure with what legislation I've seen, again, what the side rails are and how they're going to efficiently collect the due bed taxes on that, which we all, so that the services that we enjoy are supported. So there's going to be a lot. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion on that.
Well, one of the things that will happen just briefly is you'll have to have a license. And as a result, you'll be paying taxes. You're right. I think this is kind of the thing that you look at and say, well, does this seem simple? Well, it's replacing a whole section dealing with bed and breakfast. And there's been a lot of discussion at the Board of Economic Development, the planning group, and all the rest of it to bring it to this point. But it also has another implication, because there's a sister legislation that will be coming along at some point dealing with accessory dwelling units, because what we're talking about is a change that is putting this under the title short-term rental, and accessory dwelling units could be long-term rentals. But of course, in the city of Palmer, and to my knowledge in the city of Wasilla also, by the way, accessory dwelling units cannot be rented long-term at the present time. So all of that discussion from the term standpoint of affecting other people who are trying to rent places, the question is, in my mind, and I'll leave it, is a small place really competition for rentals that are two-bedroom, three-bedroom houses and so on? If you have a small studio apartment, that wouldn't seem to be necessarily a competitive situation, but perhaps answering a need for people who really literally cannot afford a larger place.
So, yeah, and I think that we have to view Airbnb or bed and breakfast is much different than we do ADUs, because one is a short-term rental and the other one is more of a long-term rental, and
right.
It impacts differently. And the people that use them are different.
Right.
So there's some similarities in the fact that you're letting homeowners do more of what they want with their land, I guess. That's a similarity. But the impact to where that lays, and, everything to me lies in the ability to collect whatever. It's easier to collect what you're due on an ADU because your square footage is going to go up, which means your property tax is going to go up. But on the B&Bs, it's what you hope is everybody gets a license, and that you hope that the city has enough personnel to enforce the collection of those taxes, which is in itself, it can be an issue in some places. I have a friend that lives in a tourist town, and while she has a bed and breakfast herself, and while she had no problem with Airbnb getting there, it came to their attention that a lot of them, once it was okay to have Airbnb, were not actually collecting taxes. And she and others that have been doing it for a long time were quite upset because, they're paying their fair share and they want everybody to pay their fair share. And they actually hired somebody within the city to do that, and their collection rates went up 60%.
Well, that sounds good. Yeah.
I think they have to look at those things and say, okay, we're going to expand this footprint. And when you expand on an ADU, put a little strain on your government, but by and large, it's just your assessor's office. and some enforcement because you want them to do it the right way and permitting. But when you're doing bed and breakfast, it's a, to me anyway, it's a different beast, and that, because it's going to be continuous revenue that you're going to have to monitor.
Right.
There's a way to do it, you know, minimum days, you know, some spot auditing, there's all kinds of things to do it. But, you know, Palmer is a different community. It's becoming quite a destination community because we're the foothills of all these beautiful mountains that people like to climb up. People like to come and bike here. We have wonderful restaurants. We have great shops. And they all depend upon not just the people that live here, but people that come in and enjoy the place. And, you know, friends and visitors and family. So to find a balance to that is really the secret sauce.
Okay, well, we've given heads up. So if listeners can take a look and have interests in this particular topic, then have at it. Well, Citizen Lobbyist, I want to thank you. It's been a good day, a good discussion.
Yeah. There'll be another assembly meeting next week, Mike. I'll be in Fairbanks for next week, so...
We'll have it covered. It's going to be streamed and all the rest, and we'll go from there.
You've been listening to The Citizen Lobbyist, broadcast on Thursdays at 8 a.m. and repeated at 5 p.m. on Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. You can find the podcast at radiofreepalmer.org. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions, please email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.